Chapter 4. The Culture of Postmodernism. The relationship between the climate of ideas outlined in previous chapters and the making of art is a complex one. Not surprisingly, many, but not all, who saw their work as innovatory or avant-garde were attracted to the new critical challenge of postmodernist themes. But it has to be borne in mind that creative people may not need any deep philosophical or academic understanding of such matters. They can also get their new ideas from the conversation and journalism which so often mediate them, and they will sometimes get them wrong, or semi-digested, or exaggerated. But that is the way in which important ideas, like viruses, can catch on in society. Conversely, postmodernist thinkers and critics have often wished to co-opt the artistic avant-garde as exemplars of the importance and influence of their ideas. Lyotard, not surprisingly, saw it as the job of contemporary artists to question the role of the meta-narrative of modernism, which was used to legitimize certain kinds of work. In The Postmodern Explained to Children, Correspondence from 1982 to 1985, from 1992, he asks artists to question the rules of painting or of narrative as they have learned them from their predecessors. Soon those rules must appear to them as a means to deceive, to seduce, and to reassure, which makes it impossible for them to be true. Indeed, it is typical of many postmodernist commentators, such as Andreas Heussen, that they see the true function of the avant-garde as being critical in the postmodernist sense. It should attack the bourgeois institutions of art and therefore be directed to a better future. Of course, this is far from true of all the avant-garde movements in our period or before it. It is a political prescription, which would hardly capture, for example, what Charles Jenks and his colleagues, whose view of postmodernism is highly eccentric to that sketched here, would understand as postmodernism in defending a conservative return to an admittedly parodic neoclassicist realism in painting and in architecture. Postmodernist art therefore echoes in very various and often indirect ways the doctrines we have discussed earlier. It resists the master narrative of modernism and the authority of high art which modernism itself takes from the past, and it worries about its own language. It is often simply unconcerned by the relationship between the formerly high and low genres, for example, as expressed in the two symphonies, Low, from 1992, and Heroes, from 1997, by Philip Glass, based on the work of David Bowie and Brian Eno. And it can often look quite trivial and popular and tacky. An alliance with popular culture is seen as anti-elitist, anti-hierarchical, and dissenting. It disrupts narrative, as can be seen, for example, in the figurative painting of Eric Fischel and David Sally, because a coherent narrative too easily allies itself to a grand one. That is why painters like Anselm Kiefer, who devote themselves to grandiose works with a deep relation to history and myth, so significantly lie outside the postmodernist mainstream. Much postmodernist art pays attention to hitherto marginalized forms of identity and behavior. This runs from the serious feminist work of Mary Kelly, who documented her relationship to her baby son in Postpartum Document from 1973 to 1979. Document here reveals the nature of the work as a politically significant text, rather than as a formally organized image designed to give visual pleasure. To Madonna's stage performances and her book Sex from 1992, in which the relationship to pleasure is entirely different, and which shocked so many feminists for her apparent theatrical submission to sadomasochistic practices as the victim of men. This critical attitude, as we shall see, often issues in pastiche, parody, and irony. Hence, for example, Jeff Koons's kitschy New Hoover Convertible from 1980, which is indeed just a commercially available cleaning machine, floats over fluorescent lights in a plexiglass case. It is a parody of the Duchampian ready-made, because it is indeed a desirable consumerist object, rather than a mere urinal or bicycle wheel. But its economic desirability is loosely confused with, or ironized by, its aesthetic pseudo-admirability, now that it has become a work of art displayed in a museum case rather than packed in a cardboard box to take home. And his New Hoover Quadriflex multiplies this by 4. The aim of many working in the avant-garde arts was very often the traditional modernist one, of defamiliarization, now guided by a more radical postmodernist epistemology. The aim, post Derrida, Foucault, and Barthes, whose ideas in variously garbled forms swam over the pronouncements of artists since the 1970s, was to prevent the consumer as subject from feeling at home in the world, for that would lead to a merely conservative, pragmatic accommodation to it. The disruption of any temptation to settle for a familiar world, as opposed to a confrontation with the disturbing qualities of a Barthesian one, is central to the work of Walter Abisch, notably in his classically postmodernist narrative, How German Is It?, from 1980. Here, both the narrator and the text he creates are subject to radical uncertainties of plot, causality, theme, and so on, which are mercilessly passed on to the reader in a tone of wandering skepticism. Consider, for example, the following paragraph from his story, The English Garden, out of which How German Is It? Grew, from In the Future Perfect, from 1977, which is cunningly full of the epistemological traps we have discussed. It runs, "When one is in Germany and one happens not to be German, one is confronted with the problem of determining the relevancy and, to a certain extent, the lifelikeness of everything one encounters. The question one keeps asking oneself is, how German is it? And is this the true color of Germany? Looking at the sky, one is almost prepared to believe that this is the same sky that the Germans kept watching anxiously in 1923 and 1933 and 1943, that is, when they were not distracted by the color of something else. Something more distracting, perhaps. Now the sky is blue. In German, the word is blau. But there are numerous gradations of blue, numerous choices for every child. The French say bleu, and we say blue." It is odd and disconcerting to be asked about the lifelikeness of everything. Does one expect an experience of a foreign country as a whole to be more like art than life, and hence not lifelike, unreal? Or is it that we don't see it so much as art as through more sinister political and stereotypical preconceptions? The questions Abisch asks are so often peculiarly oblique. For example, is this the true color of Germany? An odd example, for can colors be true? In representations, photographs, and coloring books, all things Abisch is much concerned with, they may be true to or true of, but only when they occur in a copy or reproduction. And, of course, most paradoxical of all is the fact that color is one of the things that cannot be conveyed to us by a mere literary text. Our descriptions of it do not suffice. Abisch, by this technique, makes us realize that we fill in the gaps in the text with our prejudices, or guilt. For example, when he suggests that the Germans may have been distracted by the color of something else. But what? By gray or brown uniforms? By juxtaposing the innocent 1923 with 1933 and 1943, the text is getting at us. And, as is made clear at the end, the us it is getting at is the English speaker. Here, and in the brilliant chapter on Gisela and Aegon in How German Is It?, I think that Abisch is finessing upon an argument familiar from Barthes and elsewhere, and trying to trap us into imposing our stereotypes upon Gisela and Aegon as representative of what we take to be the new Germany. The text amusingly presents an image, stereotype, by the presentation in language of visual images from a glossy magazine article on Gisela and Aegon. He writes, "The meaning, the shades or layers of meaning, are to be found in the components. The ubiquitous gabardine suit, the paisley scarf, the white silk handkerchief displayed in the breast pocket of his jacket, the drooling schnauzer, the black leather trousers, the high-heeled boots, Gisela's swept-back blonde hair, the hairdo emphasizing a sleekness, a sexual sharpness, bringing her pale, fine-boned face into greater prominence, the gleaming car with its red leather upholstery, and finally, the partially opened French windows on the ground floor revealing vertical slivers of the interior life. All this to spell out the new German competence and a sense of satisfaction and completion. It is all there, the innate German upper and upper-middle-class instinct to combine what is essentially perfection with the menacing. Abish thus maneuvers the reader into a state of skeptical distrust with respect to the text. Its humor depends upon the incongruity we feel between the text's deadpan presentations of the not-quite-stereotypical and our resistance to it. He produces what Barthes calls a text of bliss. Roland Barthes writes in The Pleasure of the Text from 1975, "A text that imposes a state of loss, a text that discomforts, perhaps to the point of a certain boredom, that unsettles the reader's historical, cultural, and psychological assumptions, the consistency of his or her tastes, values, memories, and brings to a crisis his or her relation with language." The Postmodern Novel. As the example from Abish is designed to show, the most significant alliance between postmodernist ideas and the artistic culture in Europe and the United States has led to a sustained and skeptical relativist critique of the claims of mimesis or realism in the arts. Postmodernist philosophical doubts about the truthfully descriptive relationship of language to the world help to inspire a kind of art, from the French New Novel to magic realist fiction, which relied upon creating all sorts of stimulating confusions between fact and fiction. Brian McHale therefore argues that the dominant mode of postmodernist fiction involves an ontological uncertainty about the contradictory nature of the world projected by the text, and he turns to the work of Beckett, Robbe-Grillet, Fuentes, Nabokov, Couver, and Pynchon in support of his view. The instability of the fictional world in which we find ourselves, and the difficulty of our coming to know it in any reliable way, is obvious in many such postmodernist fictions. Everything from simple logical contradiction in Robbe-Grillet to paranoia in Pynchon to comic fantasy in Bartholmé to detective stories Chinese boxed inside other detective stories, as in Paul Auster, gets in the way. In such work, simple facts about the world of the novel are contradicted. There may be no reliable center of consciousness, and the narrator, for example, Oedipa Maas in Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49 from 1967, may be notoriously confused, or perhaps mad, that is, in that ambiguous mental state which affects a fair number of postmodernist protagonists. An ontological uncertainty is also reinforced by the way in which the dramatis personae may wander into the text from history or from other fictions, so that in Couver's The Public Burning from 1977, President Richard Nixon attempts to seduce Ethel Rosenberg on the eve of her execution. In Doctorow's Ragtime from 1975, Freud and Jung take a trip together through the Tunnel of Love in an American amusement park. And in Guy Davenport's Christ Preaching at the Henley Regatta in his Eclogues from 1981, Bertie Wooster and Mallarmé and Raoul Dufy, who has come to sketch the proceedings and is nearly run down by a Jaguar XKE, and, of course, Stanley Spencer, stand side by side on the riverbank. Postmodernist work like this contrasts strongly with modernist fiction, even of the most complex Faulknerian or Joycean kind, which nearly always played fair in the relationship of the text to a historically possible world, so that an answer to the puzzle, an intelligible use of cause and effect, and a consistent chronology can nearly always be reconstructed by the informed reader. It is just such features that postmodern fiction deconstructs. In staging a confrontation between the world of the text and our own, it enacts a disturbingly skeptical triumph over our sense of reality, and hence also over the accepted narratives of history. The result has been a number of works of art in the distinctively postmodern genre of historiographical metafiction. This mixes historical and fictional material, and thereby implies or states a postmodernist critique of the realist norms for the relationship of fiction to history, as we saw Hayden White and others doing earlier. One of the most popular of those works that play with the notion of history as narrative and with the retrospective ironies that can go with that is John Fowles's The French Lieutenant's Woman from 1969, a love story about a young Darwinian named Charles, his conventional fiancée Ernestina, and a distracting young woman, Sarah Woodruff. The novel not only contains an ironical commentary by the author on the events portrayed. The author knows about Darwin. His hero is only at the beginnings of the discovery of evolution. The author also knows that his heroine is a proto-existentialist. But she, of course, does not, as she finally makes her way to a refuge from Fowles's plot in the Chelsea of the Rossettis. There is also a deliberate revealing of the author's manipulations, as he offers a postmodernist commentary on the Victorian period, for example, on Victorian attitudes to sex, and on his own plot, which parallels or parodies those of the Victorian novel, particularly Hardy. Fowles writes in The French Lieutenant's Woman, "This story I am telling is all imagination. These characters I create never existed outside my own mind. If I have pretended until now to know my characters' minds and innermost thoughts, it is because I am writing in, just as I have assumed some of the vocabulary and voice of, a convention universally accepted at the time of my story, that the novelist stands next to God. He may not know all, yet he tries to pretend that he does. But I live in the age of Alain Robbe-Grillet and Roland Barthes. If this is a novel, it cannot be a novel in the modern sense of the word. So perhaps I am writing a transposed autobiography. Perhaps I now live in one of the houses I have brought into the fiction. Perhaps Charles is myself disguised. Perhaps it is only a game. Modern women like Sarah exist, and I have never understood them. Or perhaps I am trying to pass off a concealed book of essays on you." All this leads to all sorts of serious paradoxes about the characters thinking of themselves as free, whereas we with hindsight can see them as very much determined by the perspectives, and of course the discourses, of their time. There is as much self-consciousness and reflexivity, relativism, and skepticism here as any postmodernist could want. We can be inside and sympathetic to the characters, typical of the realist novel, at the same time as being outside and judging them, from an ironically inappropriate contemporary point of view. At the end of the novel, the author, having taken a look at his hero in a railway carriage, offers the reader two alternative endings. The opening episode in Julian Barnes's A History of the World in 10.5 Chapters from 1989 is an account of Noah's Ark as given by a woodlouse, Anobium domesticum, who is very well informed, it seems, about recent history. For him, the Ark is more like a prison ship, and the biblical account of it is just a myth. This is a parodic, skeptical story about a story from the bottom level. "We didn't know anything about the political background. God's wrath with his creation was news to us. We just got caught up in it willy-nilly." Like so many, one thinks, the technique of the book, as its 10.5 stories interact, is perpetually to make us look for such ironic parallels to recent political history. In many of the episodes, socially marginal groups are on a ship and are shipwrecked or attacked. Not that the woodlouse would have approved of any official version. He thinks that Genesis discriminates against serpents. His model is a more Darwinian one anyway. God's plan of recruitment for the Ark was entirely incompetent. For example, he forgot to allow for the fact that some animals are a bit slow. He writes, "There was a particularly relaxed sloth, for instance. An exquisite creature, I can vouch for it personally, who had scarcely got down to the foot of its tree before it was wiped out in the great wash of God's vengeance. What do you call that? Natural selection? I'd call it professional incompetence." The woodlouse is the worker, the voice of the repressed, criticizing the bosses and their dominant discourse amongst much else in this amazingly inventive book. Noah and his family just eat up odd species on this floating cafeteria, or spaceship Earth. The Ark soon resembles, perhaps, a concentration camp in which Shem had this thing about the purity of the species. Bible, myth, history, science, and much else all run together in an achronological, ironic, and parodic parallel, in what seems to be an enormous attack on Bible or myth or politics as ideological explanation. The succeeding chapters are equally complex, and they provide an extraordinary compendium of postmodernist attitudes to history. But of course, like Abish, without any of the solemnity of theory. Patricia Waugh in Metafiction from 1984 says that works like this, suggest not only that writing history is a fictional act, ranging events conceptually through language to form a world model, but that history itself is invested like fiction, with interrelating plots which appear to interact independently of human design. In such cases, it is the fictional narrative which, in accord with the philosophical skepticism outlined earlier, is allowed to dominate, in the belief that, as we have seen, history is just another narrative, subject to our desires and stereotypical prejudices, and inevitably organized, by Barnes as a woodlouse or Fowles as a Victorian gentleman author, according to the fictional stereotypes of plot current within the society from which it emanates. It is not surprising that the novel has borne a disproportionate amount of the burden of being postmodern, because its hitherto usual discourses, in the relationship of author to the text, its apparently liberal or bourgeois individualist construction of unified character, its relationship to historical truth, lay it at so many points open to a postmodernist critique. From modernist mastery and formal control, respect for autonomy and individualism, and claims to historical explanatory force, all to be found, for example, when Joyce writes about Dublin or Faulkner about the South, we move towards a playful, disseminatory, self-conscious, evasive, often deliberately falsifying account of characters, who may exist on so many planes at once as to lack all plausible psychological unity. The postmodernist novel doesn't try to create a sustained realist illusion. It displays itself as open to all those illusory tricks of stereotype and narrative manipulation, and of multiple interpretation in all its contradiction and inconsistency, which are central to postmodernist thought. Its internal theorizing, its willingness to display to the reader its own formal workings, is also typically postmodern, not just in the novel, but also in film. For example, in Godard's adaptation of the Brechtian technique of the interpolated signpost or text, and also in visual art, which is so often about itself in this period. Postmodernist music? There is not a great deal about music in this book. This is partly because, long before the period we are concerned with, many composers had already given up background conventions like those attacked by postmodernism. For example, they had rejected the conventional tonal narrative order of the work. They had also tended to reject the influence of dominant past thinkers, who had aimed at the total organization of the piece, from Schoenberg and the 12-tone method to the totally organized serialism advocated by Boulez and others in the 1960s. These modernist formalisms were no longer of dominating interest. Many composers had indeed earlier been prone to allow theoretical specifications of what was desirable to dictate what they wrote. By the late 1960s, many composers abandoned the dream of a theoretically rigorous ordering of sounds and adopted a whole range of strategies which were compatible with the pluralism of postmodernist thought, even if not particularly inspired by it. There are nevertheless some works that offer pretty close parallels to other postmodernist art, or that were influenced by it. For example, the second movement of Luciano Berio's Sinfonia from 1968 accepts the meta-narrative backbone of the scherzo from Mahler's Second Symphony, which more or less controls its rhythmic movement, but which it then decomposes or deconstructs as it goes along. Along with this, Berio combined a parodic intertextual collage of quotations from all sorts of musical sources, bits of Bach, Schoenberg, Debussy, Lamer, Ravel, La Valse, and so on, and combines with this a performance of extracts of text from Beckett's The Unnameable, slogans from the May 1968 Evenement, quotations from Levi Strauss and Martin Luther King, and so on. He later added a fifth movement to the work, which is intended to make a typically self-conscious postmodern meta-commentary on the previous ones. And one could certainly say that his Recital 1 from 1972 sees the stream of consciousness of its heroic recitalist, which is full of fragments of her repertoire, as showing that her subjectivity is partially socially constructed or constituted by the musical texts that run through her mind. This intertextual eclectic collage of quotation, which is reminiscent in its lack of logical connection of much postmodernist painting, like that of Sally or Schnabel, is also to be found in the work of Alfred Schnittke, Toru Takemitsu, for example in his Debussyan Quotations of Dream, and many others. The polystylistic collage techniques of Schnittke make an indifferent use of high and low sources, so that his Concerto Grosso I from 1977 includes, as described in the preface to the score, formulae and forms of Baroque music, free chromaticism and microintervals, and banal popular music which enters, as it were, from the outside with a disruptive effect. But for most of the music of this period, we have works that are intricately indebted to the past, compete with it directly, or have a pluralistic approach to the combination of available styles, but that nevertheless make the completely autonomous impression of traditional concert music. For example, Ligeti's wonderful Violin Concerto from 1990 and 1992. Contemporary composers have been brilliant innovators in the devising of new languages. For example, Ligeti's use of immensely complex polymetric rhythmic sequences, exploitation of the mistunings available from natural harmonics, and so on. The main reason for the distance from postmodernism of this kind of genuinely experimental music is that it is very difficult to make music without words behave like text, or to convey those critical, oppositional, conceptualist messages to be found elsewhere in postmodernist art. The exceptions to this, for example, Cage's notorious silent piano composition, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, from 1952, only prove the rule, and in any case have had a short concert hall life and have been superseded by performance art in art galleries. It is very difficult for music alone to make any kind of political impression, except through the very uncertain dialectics of the hearer's allegorical association, as the futile controversies about the anti-Stalinist ironies of Shostakovich's symphonies have shown. It is in opera and vocal music that we might expect some approximation to postmodernist commitments to be found, but even here, there seems to be a loyalty to a coherent, ontologically relatively stable world, as, say, in Turnage's Greek from 1988, or Bert Whistle's Mask of Orpheus from 1973 through 1983, or Otis's Powder Her Face from 1994 through 1995, or Adams's Nixon in China from 1987. These are very different from the fictional narratives examined above. An exception to this is Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach from 1976, which is a cooperation with the minimalist artist Robert Wilson, and in which no coherent narrative is to be found. The politics of much musical composition in this period has been compatible with the leftist versions of postmodernism, for example in the work of Nonno and Henze. But it does not seem by and large that any really significant composers have needed to take on any very explicitly postmodernist theoretical commitments. The most one can say is that, like the postmodernists, composers were often obsessed with the nature and function of language, with its incoherences, with the exploitation of tonal-atonal contradictions, with its hidden but entirely convention-governed structures, and with the ways in which it could be used to deconstruct earlier patterns and procedures. But this is a very loose relationship to deconstruction as understood in postmodernist theory. You could equally say, and many have, that Cubism deconstructed Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. But this is no more than an analogy, and has no grip on the historical intentions of Picasso and Braque. Very few composers in this period have wasted time in crowing over the internal contradictions of their predecessors. Even Pierre Boulez, a former denouncer of the past, Schoenberg is dead, is now conducting Bruckner with the Vienna Philharmonic. At the very least, much musical composition since 1970, notably in the extraordinary willingness to mix styles of younger composers, has avoided some of the dialectical battles of the past, Schoenberg versus Stravinsky, theoretical serialism versus chance in the 1950s and 1960s. In this, it owes much to the climate of ideas created by postmodernism. Art and theory. As I have tried to show, it is the alliance between art and theory which is one of the most obvious symptoms of postmodernist influence. In this respect, it develops the already very strong theoretical line of science, artistic rule, or law, found in parts of high modernism, in the Bauhaus, 12-tone music, Le Corbusier, and even, in a far less rigorous and scientific manner, in surrealism. Postmodernist theory has brought into existence a plethora of works of art whose makers and critics are deeply self-conscious about their relationship to language in general and to the previously accepted languages of art in particular. With the rise of academic postmodernism and the growing influence of the political attitudes of the 1960s, both of which actually come after the post-war experimental avant-garde had established many new techniques in the arts, many artists became extraordinarily sensitive about their theoretical and their political position. They demanded from the reader and spectator an awareness of a postmodernist meta-language, which was often needed in order to supplement, complete, and to clothe in critical emperor's clothes artworks that were often austere and boring, like the bricks with which we began. Many modernist works aimed at a kind of self-explanatory autonomy. All you need to understand, for quartets in particular, is a continued application to its internal meanings and the widest possible knowledge of life, including theology and history. But postmodernist works were not complete without the critical discussion which was supposed to surround them. It is this conceptualist self-reflexivity which is so often the sign of a postmodernist origin. For the postmodernist, to create is to be critically self-aware to an extent that goes far beyond modernism, which is nevertheless responsible for the beginnings of this dire marriage between art and academic elitism. Artist and critic both conspire to demand the right relationship between work and idea, as implied by the creator and as responded to by the audience. Conceptualism. We can see how this works if we look at an example. Paul Crowther's classically postmodernist account of Malcolm Morley's huge painting in oils of a postcard of the SS Amsterdam in front of Rotterdam, from 1966. Morley took a postcard, inverted it, projected it on a screen, covered the projection with a grid, and then copied it upside down on a very large scale, even including the white margins of the card. Crowther argues that this superrealism is a critical practice which highlights, questions, and thwarts our expectations of art as a high cultural activity. It does indeed thwart any expectation of a high cultural complexity. It addresses the legitimizing discourse whereby art is justified as a vehicle of elevation and improvement. That is, it does a bit of Foucauldian questioning, though quite what the activity of addressing amounts to remains unclear here, as in most postmodernist uses of this piece of jargon. Elevation and improvement are clearly going to be the wrong kinds of values to expect in this context. But that may still be a pity. No one could possibly think that Morley's ship is elevating or improving. Crowther goes on, "In Morley's case, the critical dimension is, as it were, painted into the image. But the weaseling, as it were, here disguises an impossibility. It is obviously the critic's commentary, and not the painting, which is actually providing the criticism." He goes on, "We have not so much a kind of external anti-art as art which internalizes and displays the problematics of its own socio-cultural status." Crowther adds that the work of Audrey Flack, Chuck Close, and Dwayne Hansen has a similar dimension, but that the superficially similar photorealist works of John Salt and Richard Estes are merely virtuoso performances and aesthetically dazzling compositions. He means, presumably, that the latter produce paintings that are enjoyable in a rather traditional way, which to their advantage and great formal virtuosity they are. Crowther argues that their concentration on such qualities deplorably allowed the work of Morley and the other innovators to be reappropriated within the legitimizing discourse which surrounds such values. He disapproves of their flashy verisimilitude, their overwhelming market appeal, and hence their appeal to traditional prejudices. And so, in looking like photographs, Estes's work just feeds the demand for fashionable novelty and unexpectedness that is created by modernism. The appreciation of aesthetic or virtuoso qualities is to be thought of as politically regressive, in that it allows us to defend a rather modernist aesthetic pleasure in formal composition, of which Crowther clearly disapproves. Indeed, like many other postmodernists, he attacks artists when they show such modernist qualities, which are not progressive by being critical of legitimating discourses, including those of modernism. But what then of Crowther's own legitimating discourse? Could the work of Estes be construed as a progressive criticism of that? But the work of such artists doesn't really waste much time in criticizing, explicitly or implicitly, other art. For Crowther, Morley is therefore a key artist in understanding the transition from modern to postmodern. He, and also Kiefer, surprisingly, has the anti-modernist virtues of devising a new form of art and of embodying a skepticism as to the possibility of high art, so that, by internalizing this skepticism and making it thematic within art practice, critical superrealism gives art a deconstructive dimension. It is thus definitively postmodernist, and the key to this judgment is its questioning character. Those who produced conceptual art were easily interpretable as the true guardians of the postmodernist theorizer's faith, but their thought is often sloppy by ordinary rational standards, and theory can too often inhibit the artist from being imaginative or metaphorically suggestive. You can see what is there pretty quickly, but what you can't get away from too quickly is the theoretical miasma by which the critic wishes to give it significance. This work has affinities to, and indeed helped to inspire, postmodernist thinking because it arises from a self-consciousness about the theory of art. It was not the object itself, but the conceptual processes behind it that counted. In the process, it took a step back from the usual activities of art institutions, including those of selling the object. For example, there was nothing to sell in Robert Barry's exhibition at the Art and Project Gallery in Amsterdam in 1969, which consisted in his putting on the gallery entrance a sign reading, "During the exhibition, the gallery will be closed." One consequence of this conceptualism was the loss of a feeling for complexity in art. The richness of specification of traditional mimesis and the intriguing formal relationships of modernist art were often abandoned. The result of this anti-modernist turn could be a deliberate shallowness, as in much minimalist art, in music, as well as in painting. Michael Fried argued that a merely literal minimalist object can only have interest for the spectator as dramatically placed within an exhibition space, and this contrasts to its disadvantage with the modernist mode, in which the spectator is engaged by the complexity and formal configuration of the object. One mode demands interaction, the other is a contemplation of internal relations. For Fried, the minimalists are mere literalists who rely on our self-awareness as the spectators of art objects, whereas in the modernist internal tradition, we can lose ourselves in absorption in the work of art. This theatricality is at war with modernism. To put it pretty crudely, we enjoy exploring the internal relations of a work sculpted by Anthony Caro, but a heap of felt by Robert Morris offers us no such opportunities. Rather, it poses questions. The conceptualism of early artists like Morris and André inspired many later postmodernist developments in which the conceptual and the minimal were often combined, to ask questions through quite simple works of art. An example is Michael Craig Martin's 1973 exhibition of a glass of water on an ordinary bathroom glass shelf 9 feet high on the wall, which he entitles An Oak Tree. It was the only object in the exhibition room. Visitors were given an anonymous written questionnaire, including, Question: Haven't you simply called this glass of water an oak tree? Answer: Absolutely not. It is not a glass of water anymore. I have changed its actual substance. It would no longer be accurate to call it a glass of water. One could call it anything one wished, but that would not alter the fact that it is an oak tree.